The following talk was recorded at Libra Planet 2023, Charting the Course, an annual conference on current issues in ethics, social justice, and technology from the Free Software Foundation. Libra Planet is a live conference, and speakers often use slides and other visual tools to assist their presentation. You can see the videos of these talks at media.libraplanet.org or on the FSF PeerTube channel. Libra Planet speakers do not represent the mission of the Free Software Foundation. We host speakers talking about their uses of free software in different kinds of political and commercial work. The FSF supports their freedom, but does not take a position on any political issues other than those necessary to uphold the principles of free software. Like all the FSF's work on behalf of the freedom of all computer users, Libra Planet is made possible by thousands of individuals. To keep our work going, please consider becoming an associate member via my.fsf.org/join. or by making a donation at my.fsf.org/donate. You can stay informed by subscribing to our newsletter, The Free Software Supporter, at fsf.org/fss. For more information on Libra Planet, please visit libraplanet.org/conference.
Hi, everybody. I'm Liz Chamberlain. I'm iFixit's Director of Sustainability, and I'm here to talk to you about the future of the right to repair and free software. As Director of Sustainability at iFixit, that means I work about a quarter of my time on internal sustainability work, like life cycle analyses of our toolkits and that sort of thing, and the rest of the time advocating for the right to repair, working to support laws and regulations that make the world a more repairable place. In case you don't already know us, iFixit is a site that publishes step-by-step repair manuals with pictures for all kinds of things. Our mission is to teach the world how to fix everything. We've got over 90,000 guides in a dozen languages. Those are free in the gratis sense, but also wiki-editable with a Creative Commons license. Our guides cover everything from toasters to tractors. We're especially focused on consumer electronics because we started in 2003 when our co-founder, Kyle, that's him here, he just had a baby yesterday, by the way, so congratulations to baby Jax. Kyle dropped an iBook off his dorm room bed and bent the power plug. He and his friend Luke looked for repair manuals. They couldn't find them, so they took apart the laptop, figured out how to fix it themselves, and wrote their own guide. And it turns out, A lot of other people had the same problem because Apple refused and until very recently continued to refuse to publish repair instructions or make parts available. So Kyle and Luke systematically documented repairs for every Apple product, put them up online, free as in beer. To pay for server time, they harvested parts from broken machines and sold them. 20 years later, our business model is basically the same. We make free guides, we sell parts and tools. And our community has grown hugely along with us. In each of our dozen languages, we've got an answers forum where repair experts answer questions from DIYers and each other. And our in-house tech writers and translators are supported by thousands of volunteers from all over the world. I mentioned that guides on our site are wiki-editable. Anyone with an account can make a guide or edit a guide. They are patrolled by our own in-house tech writers. We check guides that are submitted through the wiki. But if you're following along a guide and you notice something that's unclear or should be worded better or it's misleading, there's an edit button at the top of every step. So I encourage you, if you're on iFixit, using iFixit, hit that edit button, contribute to the community. Or you can leave a comment with additional information. I know it's kind of tiny here, but this comment points out that on this user's device, their Torx screws, not Phillips. And that's really useful, right? That's useful information that on, you know, different machines, there are different screw layouts. So this is what it looks like within the edit interface. iFixit's very first repair guides were PDFs, but once we had a team of repair engineers working together, it became clear that we needed something more collaborative than InDesign. And a wiki makes a lot of sense for repair information because it means that guides can get better over time. As the community learns better ways of doing things, the guides can reflect that learning. We can add warnings and additional information that people have found useful. Again, iFixit content, including all of our guides, all of our photos, it's all Creative Commons license. Our guides run the gamut. We've got, you know, I said everything from toasters to tractors, but our parts and tools business is focused on electronics repair. We also take apart new gadgets when they come out to get a sense of how difficult they'll be to repair. This is one of our first, the iPod Classic teardown. In our teardown heyday, we'd line up and camp out the night before big product releases to get our teardowns up as fast as possible. This is Kyle again, and one of our early tech writers. At first, our teardowns just warned people about potential repair challenges. So this iPod Classic teardown warns people that the 13 metal clips around the outside of the device are tough to pry apart, they're easy to bend out of place, and it can be hard to get it back together after you do so. But a few years into doing teardowns, we started giving repairability scores to things we took apart, rating them on a scale from 0 to 10. We're especially focused on how difficult it is to get at batteries and screens. That's because batteries are consumable. They need replacing every 1 to 3 years. They will have to be replaced at some point. And screens are often the most likely to break component of a device. So I know the text is probably kind of tiny from the back, but I'm curious if anyone wants to guess what device this is that scored a 2 out of 10. I can read some of these to you. So displays and back glass covers can be replaced without disassembling any other components. That's good. Not so good. Batteries are glued, require extensive disassembly. USB-C port is soldered directly to the main board. Uncommon tri-point screws secure key components. Delicate OLED panels are not well protected from accidental prying, yet must be removed for most repairs. And there's stubborn glue at all entry points, complicating any repair attempt. Does anyone want to guess? Any thoughts?
Was that the Google Pixel?
Good thought. Not the Google Pixel, but that's a good guess. Anyone else? Yeah, you're close. You're close. It's the Surface Duo. So we're not big fans of the folding revolution. The big clue there is multiple screens, multiple batteries, everything glued down. And that's exactly why we're not a big fan of the folding revolution, because there are multiple screens, multiple batteries, more things glued down. But iFixit is proof that if you complain loud and hard enough, you can start to make change. For a long time, our cries fell on deaf ears at manufacturers. We were kind of screaming things into the manufacturer void. We'd ask them to make more repairable products and hear nothing back. They wouldn't take our calls. But within the last few years, major manufacturers have started talking about repairability, and some of them have even started to approach us to ask what they can do to make stuff more repairable. In some cases, they've asked for help. So we help Patagonia and Fairphone make guides for their customers. For Home Depot's tool rental center, we documented all the most common repairs for the tools that they rent out. They let us put all the guides we made for them on our site for the public. And most recently, we've become the official repair parts provider for both Google Pixel and Samsung Galaxy. As you can imagine, we were a little wary about these collaborations at first. I know this crowd has a lot of complaints about these companies, so do we. We've been pushing back hard against their unrepairable stuff for a long time. And we don't want to be used as a tool of repair washing. But we're happy for a chance to talk with engineers at some of these companies at the start of the design process, be talking about repairability from the very beginning. And it's let us take some big steps toward that mission of teaching the world how to fix everything. As much as we would like to believe that executives woke up one day and saw the repairability light, we know that's not what happened. They see right to repair legislation coming. They know that soon they'll be required to make parts, tools, repair documentation available, because law passed in New York. The right to repair is the idea that if you bought something, you own it, you should be able to fix it. That means you should be able to fix it yourself. So look under the hood, both in the hardware and the software, or you should be able to take it to a repair shop of your choice. And manufacturers shouldn't be able to use anti-competitive practices to restrict the repair market, making repair more expensive, less available for everyone. iFixit has been working on right to repair laws since 2014 with our friends at the Public Interest Research Group, Repair.org, Secure Repairs. And we've had some really big wins lately. And honestly, a lot of those wins are sort of wins with a question mark. Nobody wants to compromise, but that is the name of the advocacy game. So a couple of those things recently. The EU passed rules for smartphones and tablets at the end of last year. Those rules will require smartphone and tablet manufacturers to make parts and tools available for 7 years, and software updates available for 5 years past the end of life of their products. This is really good news. It's big news. But of course, again, it comes with some compromises. Right at the end of the process, lawmakers took out controls for software pairing of parts. This is the process that Apple uses to make sure that you only use official batteries and screens. Our advocate friends in the EU fought really hard to make that illegal, but the law got stripped at the last moment. Lawmakers also stripped controls for parts pricing at the last minute. This means that if a manufacturer really wants you to buy a new phone instead of a new screen, and they do, they want you to buy a new phone, not a new screen, they can set the price for that screen right at the point where their market research says you will say, oh no, it's too expensive to get a new screen, I'll just get a new phone. Our EU advocacy friends, again, worked really hard to write language that would set some controls of part pricing, and it got left out. Very disappointing. About a month later, we started feeling some deja vu in the US. So the first US electronics right to repair bill passed the New York legislature in June, and then it sat in legislative limbo for 6 months while we waited and waited and waited for the governor to call it to her desk. And long waits in advocacy are scary, because manufacturers have lots of lobbyists, lots of time to bend ears. And Governor Hochul's ear clearly got bent, because she made a bunch of changes to the bill at the last minute that, you know, exactly reflected what manufacturers were asking for. So we were really happy with this bill when it left the House and the Senate in New York. We were a lot less happy with it when it left the governor's desk. We still tried to be positive about the things that this bill gets us. It does get us parts and tools, gets us software, gets us documentation. Louis Rossman's take was that the governor sabotaged the bill. I don't think it's quite that bad, but the concessions were disappointing. And they're frustrating because our opposition knows what they got. CTA is one of our biggest opponents. This is a lobbying organization. Most electronics manufacturers are signed on because they have to be in order to present their products at CES, the big electronics show. CTA sends lobbyists to every hearing in every state around the country to argue against right to repair. And now that they got what they wanted in New York, CTA has been sending letters to every state arguing that the bill should be modified exactly the way that the New York bill was modified, calling out specific points of language that should be changed. It's very frustrating. So, okay, what changes did CTA get in New York? Lewis is most mad about the change that lets manufacturers combine parts into assemblies if they can argue that it's safer for customers. Lewis, for anyone who's not familiar, is a right-to-repair YouTuber who runs a board-level repair business. He does micro-soldering, replacing chips and capacitors instead of whole boards. We're really familiar with this issue at iFixit because we've been pushing manufacturers on this from the inside for a long time. Sometimes we've won those arguments. Sometimes we've lost. Samsung, for instance, wouldn't sell official Galaxy batteries on their own. They insisted we sell the batteries and screens together in one assembled unit because the battery is glued to the screen. And manufacturers are super duper afraid of exploding batteries. Or really, their lawyers are afraid. We made this video late last year to try to address some of those worries. It turns out that even when you're trying to start a battery fire, actively stabbing the battery, it doesn't always happen. Often doesn't. And if you drain the battery properly, as we tell people to do at the start of our guides, you aren't going to start a fire. Obviously, battery fires are no good. You don't want battery fires. People should be aware of the risk and know what to do when it happens. What you do when it happens is you carry the battery outside and you let it burn out outside. It'll happen in a few minutes. It'll burn out. And it's a small risk. It's easily manageable. It's way less dangerous than changing a tire. I encourage you to try Googling deaths from changing a tire, deaths from changing a cell phone battery. A lot of tire changing deaths. So it's a lot less dangerous than changing a tire. And if manufacturers stopped gluing down batteries, there would be basically no risk. But good luck getting a manufacturer lobbyist to admit that. So, okay, it's really, really frustrating that manufacturers got out of being required to sell components by claiming a safety risk. So many times, a $1,000 machine gets scrapped for the failure of a 10-cent capacitor. There were some other disappointing things in New York. It excluded medical devices, police radios, data center equipment. But we're not too worried about those kinds of exclusions. We can get those things in other bills. The first goal of U.S. right to repair legislation is parity with manufacturer repair. We want DIYers and independent shops to be able to do the same kinds of repairs for competitive prices that manufacturers authorized shops do. That helps keep healthy competition in the repair market. It makes sure that repairs are available when people need things fixed. New York's bill is a huge step in that direction. There have been other recent wins with a question mark. You might have seen headlines in January claiming that John Deere conceded to farmers on repair issues. The fight to get farmers the right to fix their own tractors has been hard and dirty. Maybe some of you came to CITCODE's panel, CITCODE's talk yesterday, or the panel right before this one. Deere has a huge, highly profitable monopoly on repair. When anything breaks on a tractor that interfaces with the emissions control system, which is many, many things that have nothing to do with emissions, farmers have to call out a dealer to handle that repair. The tractor goes into limp mode, which enables just enough of the drive system to get the machine off the field, out of the way of other equipment. And because of Deere's repair consolidation, there might only be a few dealerships in the state, and nobody else around who can work on that equipment anymore, so they're stuck. And during busy times, farmers might wait weeks for a dealer to come out. In harvest time, That can mean a total loss of a crop. Really expensive, really devastating for farmers. So Deere has a repair monopoly. They use that monopoly to make themselves even more money. They collect farm data by surveilling their customers and use it to create gated software features that they then sell back to farmers at thousands a pop. And they use those profits to hire insane numbers of lobbyists to buy out politicians. Kevin Kenney, who's on the panel just now, told me that on the day of a key vote for a Nebraska farm right to repair bill, less than half of the state senators showed up. They abstained by being absent. That's because they know that people in the state wouldn't want to see them vote against repair. So instead, they didn't show up. And so there weren't enough votes in the state house to pass. The same day that over half of the legislature just didn't show up, there were so many Deere lobbyists in the building, Kevin joked they would have to expand the rotunda. Okay, what do you think? Did Deere concede? No, okay, no. Yeah, you're right. No, Deere signed a memorandum of understanding with the American Farm Bureau Federation. They made some promises that went beyond anything that they've said before. They said some things that made it sound like they might offer access to some parts of repair diagnostic software that they've kept gated before. But they've yet to make good on that promise, and it's pretty much unenforceable. So, okay, cool. If they do eventually make good on it, great. But meanwhile, they made the American Farm Bureau Federation agree to stop lobbying for right-to-repair laws the day before a farm bill vote. And still, the full diagnostic Deere software, the diagnostic service and repair software, is only available to dealers. We want success to be a straight line. It's not. There are lots of squiggles. That said, there have been some pretty unequivocal wins in the right-to-repair fight. France now requires all electronics manufacturers to score their devices' repairability on a scale from 0 to 10, based on things like how long it takes to disassemble, whether parts are available. And manufacturers have to show that score at the point of sale. When asked, lots of French consumers say that these scores make them willing to pick a more repairable product over a product from a company that they know. Knowledge is power. It's great to have this kind of information. The EU also passed a law that will require electronics manufacturers to make batteries user-replaceable by 2026 or 2027. And meanwhile, in the US, we are deep into a very active legislative session. We're up to 46 bills in 25 states just this year. And we're fighting a war of attrition against manufacturers, and we are starting to win. Since iFixit, PERG, and Repair.org started running bills in 2014, there's been at least one right-to-repair bill in 44 of 50 states. Only 6 states in the U.S. have not yet had a right-to-repair bill. A lot of those bills focus on tractors and smartphones, some also on medical devices. And last year, in addition to the New York bill, we passed a right-to-repair powered wheelchairs bill in Colorado.
Yay!
Absolutely. And there is even more good news from Colorado. When I sent the slide deck earlier this week to the Libre Planet people, I put the slide in here hopefully because we didn't know it was going to happen. And I am thrilled now to be able to say that on Thursday, Colorado's agricultural right to repair bill passed the Senate on a vote of 25-8 after passing the House 44-17. It's great news. It's got to go back to the House for reconciliation and then to the governor for a signature, but we're as hopeful as we've ever been that those things will happen. And it's looking like Deere is going to have to blink. Deere is just one of many, many manufacturers using non-free software to block repair. You ever been at a McDonald's, tried to order an ice cream, they tell you the machine's broken? There's this website that tracks broken ice cream machines by creating an online order, trying to add an ice cream to the cart every few minutes. And at any given time, you go to this website, about 10% of McDonald's across the country probably have a broken ice cream machine. When I checked last night, the closest machine to us right now was down. Don't try it. Not worth it. The problem is that the machines give these really obscure error codes, like this one, RBRL > 41F after SL. Good luck decoding that without the proprietary manual. You might be able to figure that out. Even if you did figure it out, though, you wouldn't know how to reset the machine. You wouldn't know the combination of buttons to press to do it. So it's the same story as Deere, except McDonald's is playing the role of the farmer. Instead of John Deere, you have Taylor, the ice cream machine company. So some red teamers went to McDonald's a few years back and said, hey, can we hack your machines and try to solve this ice cream machine problem? And McDonald's emailed back, sure, go, do it. And that's how Melissa Nelson and Jeremy O'Sullivan ended up making Kitsch, which is a Raspberry Pi powered McDonald's ice cream machine error code reader, basically. It let franchise owners remotely diagnose and troubleshoot machines, so franchisees loved it. Taylor, of course, hated it. It's not good for their paid repair service. So corporate McDonald's hired some engineers to create their own Kitsch-like device. They reverse engineered Kitsch and sent out an email to all franchise owners saying not to do business with Kitsch anymore. But there was that pesky little business of the email where they gave them permission. And so Kitsch is now suing McDonald's for $900 million damages for the loss of business. Godspeed. Good luck, Kitsch. Meanwhile, Apple has an important battery message for you. Did you take a battery out of one iPhone, put it in another one that you're refurbishing? Don't do that. This message will show up on your home screen repeatedly for 48 hours, and then it'll be a red, undismissable notification in your settings forever, and your battery health indicator won't work. And it's not just batteries. More and more parts are paired to device IMEIs like this. In the iPhone 12, almost 50% of parts were paired. And a rising share of parts can't be reprogrammed by micro-soldering the microcontroller from one old phone to the new one. You already know this isn't just Apple. It's happening in chainsaws, in TVs, in washing machines, food processors, cars, and extra famously in game consoles. Xbox and PlayStation optical drives are paired to the motherboard. Fixing an optical drive should be a $20 repair. Instead, it's more like $200 because you have to replace the motherboard at the same time. And since optical drives are one of the most mechanically complex parts in a game console, they fail extra often. So eBay is chock full of these Xboxes and PlayStations with broken optical drives being sold on the cheap for parts harvesting. TronicsFix did this great video explaining right to repair while stacking a bunch of these broken Xboxes. No spoilers, PS4s, not Xboxes. No spoiler, you have to go see how many he stacked while talking about right to repair. It is legal to hack your own Xbox or PlayStation. The Copyright Office says so. We fought for that exemption every few years. The manufacturer can't void your warranty for doing your own repairs. The FTC says so. And yet, call center veterans like this guy say that they routinely deny service when they find evidence that customers have been modifying the software or hardware in their game consoles. This is especially sad for the Xbox, which used to have such a great hacking community following Bunny Wong's awesome manifesto. As I mentioned, DRM is also a major issue for powered wheelchair users. That's one of the things that the Colorado bill addressed.
I'm in that article.
You're in that article.
I'm the auditor that they quote in that article.
Oh, how cool. Well, then definitely go read it. This is Cory Doctorow on the EFF page. Wynn Perg surveyed wheelchair users in Colorado before the bill came out. This is published in a great report that Paul Roberts wrote, actually. They found that 93% of wheelchair users needed service in the last year, often waited 7 weeks for service.
That's bad.
Really?
On April 5th, I will have been waiting 1 year for replacing tires and caster wheels on my manual wheelchair.
That's awful.
They come with a supply chain problem.
Wow.
After 11 and a half months, they finally fixed my shower chair.
Wow. Over a year, 11 and a half months. That's not acceptable.
That's a company called New Motion.
Yep.
I always call No Motion.
No Motion. Yep. New Motion is No Motion, absolutely. Yeah. I was going to say that that waiting 7 weeks in a year for service is, 87% uptime, something like that, zero nines of uptime. But waiting a full year is 0% uptime. That's terrible. So we know that these issues that people faced in Colorado are happening all around the country. New Motion is the major wheelchair manufacturer across the country. So we're working on wheelchair bills. There are a couple more in progress right now. We're hoping that those protections will be extended to the rest of the country, too. One of the most frustrating things about the DRM fight is that we've won it over and over again, but not in the ways that matter for most people. Since we started petitioning the Copyright Office to grant exemptions for repair of different categories of stuff, they've granted a ton of those exemptions. So it's legal to hack your phone to fix it, legal to hack your computer, your tractor, your wheelchair, your game console, if your goal is fixing it. And for some people in the audience here, that permission is all you need to get grooving. That's great. But for most of us, what we really need is a software tool built from someone else's hacking. We need a device like the Kitch for all these other things. And unless you've got an email from McDonald's proving that they gave you permission to hack, you can't distribute what you've found without violating the DMCA. So we're working on it. There was a bill in Congress last session that would have made distributing those tools legal, and we expect that it'll be reintroduced this session. Meanwhile, hackers are gonna hack. Kate Gray found that you can get around Keurig DRM by removing the green wire. Chucksman extracted the firmware from his washing machine's microcontroller. And my boss, Kyle, sponsored a few years of students from our local university, Cal Poly, who were trying to hack John Deere. Cal Poly runs on quarters, so each group of students would work on it for a few weeks, then pass it on to the next group. They were using a different angle than Sitco's was. They were looking at the CAN bus system. CAN bus is basically OBD for heavy equipment. So they hardware hacked this device that I show here to convert the tractor's CAN bus signal to USB. They figured out which pins meant what. They turned the tractor on, they got a nice stream, and from one of the few diagnostic codes that Deere does publish publicly, they were able to search in the data stream and do some reverse engineering. The most recent team to work on this problem got to a point where they could artificially manipulate the tractor's RPM, so it would look like it was redlined even when it was in park. So this is really cool. It's not super useful yet, but they've made a lot of progress. Their work is up on GitHub, so if you want to go mess around in their data dump, you're welcome to do so. One of the alum of that program has gone on to create an ag tech startup called Tractor Cloud. As you might have gathered, that's not an easy space to compete in. There's one company that's got a pretty huge market share. Sitcodes has gotten the furthest in hacking Deere by far. He managed to get the source, not all of it, but a lot of it, and enough to do what he needed to do, by pointing out the GNU general public license code in the console's software required it. He reverse engineered it. He got Doom running on it, and not just any Doom, but a special hilarious farm version of Doom where you mow down corn along with your enemies. The internet loved it, of course. Deere hated it, of course, but there wasn't much they could do about it because SICK was just doing what the GPL said he was allowed to do. Someone else in this fight, farmer turned farm engineer Kevin Kenny, right over there, is fighting the same fight but out in the fields yanking SIM cards out of tractors, show farmers that they don't have to be reliant on Deere's over-the-air updates. You can go, Kevin, I didn't mean to stop you. The GNU general public license is one of the most powerful tools we have for pushing back against these big corporate monopolies. So often the software that these big companies call proprietary is actually built on free software. And when courts dig into it, they usually find on the side of free software. So GPLviolations.org has had successes back to 2006. They won a case in Germany against the D-Link router company. And now, the D-Link router quick install guide has the full requisite GPL code statement right there in the quick install guide. Same story, FSFE won a case against Fantech, who also now is compliant. The Free Software Foundation has done a lot to support Right to Repair. They produced this fun video that I'm actually not going to show you right now. I'm going to save it for time. But they make the point that Right to Repair and free software share a heart. They have a lot of the same goals in mind. Repair requires getting under the hood, being able to change what you can find. That's true in both software and hardware. The FSF does have a Fight to Repair group that you should join if you're interested in this stuff. And Software Freedom Conservancy has some really promising ongoing work in that department. They're currently in the discovery phase of litigation against the television manufacturer Vizio. Vizio is already on the sort of geek shit list for privacy violations. And it turns out, of course, they've got GNU Linux in their supposedly proprietary stack. Vizio tried to get the suit dismissed, but in May last year, a California judge said that the case is valid. The GPL apparently qualifies as the extra element needed, makes this a proper breach of contract case, not just a run-of-the-mill copyright issue. This case is going forward. Again, it's in discovery right now. Software Freedom Conservancy also called out Deere publicly this week, announcing that they've been asking for Deere source for over the last 2 years across nearly a dozen requests. They've gotten no response to the majority of their requests. To the few that they have gotten a response to, it's been missing some of the installation of the executable code that really is necessary to do what they want to do. If you do have software that you'd like SFC to protect on your behalf, you can co-assign anything you've written to them, and they can protect it. They've got a link for that, the sfconservancy.org/assignment. What else can you do? You can check out repair.org, which is a great repair trade association run by the inimitable Gay Gordon Byrne, who gave this really great TED Talk about right to repair, which you should also go watch. On yourstate.repair.org, you can quickly make a letter or send a phone call. Make a phone call if you're feeling brave, brave on the phone. We'll connect you easily, quickly with your state legislators if your state is considering repair legislation. This is the Massachusetts letter. I know it's probably too tiny to read, but there is a cell phone and tablet bill in Massachusetts right now. If you live here, please do go send your legislators a note. You can also check out the Public Interest Research Group, which has been an incredibly effective organization in the state legislative fight. Nathan Proctor and Kevin O'Reilly at PIRG organized groups of people to testify in states around the country. They've made it possible for a ragtag group of activists like us to stand up against lobbyists from the biggest companies in the world, and we've got them on their back foot. There's a lot of news in the right to repair space, and it can be hard to keep up with. But Paul Roberts runs this awesome Fight to Repair weekly newsletter and podcast. I'm going to be honest, I rely on it to keep up to date with right to repair legislation and news, and it is literally my job just to keep up to date with that stuff. Okay, so that's a lot of the present and the past for talk that's supposedly about the future. So where do I see the future of right to repair and free software going? My ideal future would look a lot like Framework's awesome proof of concept. They're a laptop that's designed for repair from the start without sacrificing sleek and easy. Every part has a QR code linking to a guide for replacing that part. It comes with the one screwdriver you need to take it apart. And when they come out with a new processor, you don't have to replace your keyboard and your trackpad and your screen to take advantage of it. The M&T Reform has a lot of the same value proposition. It comes with the one screwdriver you need. It's designed to be repairable from the start. In the battery department, it beats Framework. It uses a standard set of lithium-ion phosphate batteries. Once you're inside the laptop, you can replace the batteries by hand, and they're only going to cost you about $6 for the whole set. I think all hardware should be that way. M&T Reform is closer to fully free software-wise than the Framework, but you can get the DIY edition of the Framework, which comes without an OS. They've got installation instructions for several different distros of GNU Linux, and their forums have good reports from people who are running FreeBSD too. If this guide format looks familiar, you're not crazy. This is iFixit's guide software. The Framework isn't entirely free. I'll admit that I bought the version that comes with Windows. But they've made their embedded controller open source. Their support team helps out users who want to install free software. I think all hardware companies should be that way. Fairphone is making some similar strides in cell phone hardware. Instead of replacing your whole phone when you want a new camera, why not just replace the camera module? And finally, one more shout out to Ploopy, which is making fully modular 3D printed audiophile quality headphones, also making trackballs and mice. They make source files and design files freely available for every piece of it, from hardware to software, complete documentation, full parts transparency. Again, I think all companies should be this way. 3D printing is already starting to revolutionize the way we think about repair parts. iFixit held a contest a few years back offering a prize for the best 3D printed spare part use case. And the winner was this cover for the Lumix DSLR that always breaks. The cover always breaks because it hits the table when you set the camera down. I think companies should make CAD files for parts available. If not from the start like Ploopy does, then why not when the product goes out of official service? Until then, again, hackers are going to hack. So researchers at TU Delft, 3D printer owners around the world, are working on the problem of reverse engineering repair parts to be 3D printed. Porsche has been doing it for its old cars since 2018. Why not everybody else? The line between hardware and software repairs is just getting blurrier and blurrier. You might remember when two Boeing 737 MAXs crashed in 2019 because their autopilot stabilizer malfunctioned. That wasn't just a software problem, wasn't just a hardware problem. It was a software fix to a hardware problem, and then both software and hardware failed. I heard that Tesla's full self-driving beta was supposed to launch this weekend. Does anyone know if that actually happened? Last I looked, I couldn't tell if it had actually happened. I don't know. Anyway, either way, whether it happened or not, it's coming. And Ford, ominously, just patented a system that will let cars repossess themselves. So when your car erroneously drives itself to a manufacturer's authorized repair shop instead of the independent repair shop you told it to go to. Will that be a software problem or a hardware problem? There will be 55.7 billion connected IoT devices in 2025, and those things will virtually all be non-free software running on unrepairable hardware unless we keep fighting. Now and in the future, software is everywhere, and it must be free. Hardware is everywhere. It must be free. Free to hack, free to share, free to repair, free to get into and see how it ticks and make it tick in a new way. It's not going to be easy. We've got a long way to go, but I know a ragtag bunch of activists who know how to get shit done. It is a motto, but I believe it. I hope you do too. Together, we can fix anything. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Chamberlain, for this very inspiring talk. I'll invite all members of the audience to line up to the microphone for Q&A session.
That was great.
Thank you.
Thanks. So there's another sort of part that goes bad after a few years in, you know, most battery-powered computers. You've got the battery, you've also got the software. You know, if you have a locked bootloader, after a certain amount of time, you can't even update the OS yourself.
Yeah.
You're just stuck with a useless piece of hardware.
Yeah.
So I think that's, I mean, that's a, even if we have a right to repair the hardware, if we don't have a right to update the software, we really have nothing still. We still don't have hardware that lasts. So
yeah.
Is that something that you guys at iFixit are trying to work on, or is that more of a software problem that we have to deal with?
It's a great question, and I think you're absolutely right. It's not being able to update your software can eventually basically break your hardware. So that, you know, they are intertwined. We can't look at one without the other. I think ideologically, philosophically, we're absolutely in support of free software as well, in you know, making sure that manufacturers are enabling software updates after the end of the official service life of machines. And that they've made some progress in Europe. The cell phone and tablet bill does enable 5 years of software updates, which isn't, it's not great beyond the end of service life, but, you know, better than nothing. The template legislation that we're encouraging state legislators to use for right to repair doesn't address software updates. But we see that as sort of right to repair 2.0. But once we're able to get parts, tools, repair documentation available to everybody, then software updates is the next frontier. So absolutely, we're thinking about it, we're there with you, and we will continue to fight. Getting parts, tools, and documentation is not the end. That's only the beginning of right to repair. Thank you.
I just wanted to say thank you for all of your efforts. And there is also a wheelchair repair bill in Mass. It's more addressing warranty issues and putting requirements for service companies, but there is definitely more progress being made there, I hope.
I'm really glad to hear that. Thank you.
I've been very happy to hear about the amount of support you're giving to our freedom. But I do think that on a few points, you need to recognize that the place you're trying to get to isn't far enough.
Okay.
I would suggest that being able to install a manufacturer's upgrade of a non-free program to a new non-free version of that program is not freedom. What we need is not to have non-free software in there. That's got to be the real goal, so that the user has control of this product.
Yeah, yeah.
That purse has bought.
Yeah. No, again, ideologically, philosophically, I'm there with you 100%.
We may not get there this century. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to object to the idea of incremental progress.
Sure.
It's still progress, and it may be a tremendous fight to get the incremental change.
Yeah.
But I'm suggesting make it clear that the partial improvements are not reaching the goal, that there's a goal beyond that that we shouldn't forget.
Yeah.
Even while working on an incremental improvement, fighting hard for that, always keep in mind where we really want to get and tell people that.
I love that. I think you're absolutely right. We can't rest on the laurels, and the goal is freedom to do what we want with our stuff. And absolutely, I think we need free software to get there.
Happy hacking. Send me an email.
Thank you.
We have a question from online that extends a little bit the discussion. Are you aware of any organization or associations working on fighting planned obsolescence?
Oh, planned obsolescence. Yeah. The first one that comes to mind, in France, there's a group called the HALT, I don't speak French, unfortunately, HALT Obsolescence Program, but in French. And they're doing great work. And they're actually the group that surveyed French consumers about their perceptions of the repair index. There are other groups as well, but that's the one off the top of my head. Thank you.
So I don't know if you covered this in your talk. I missed the first part of it. My apologies, but thank you so much. I've enjoyed this, and this sounds really great and is really exciting. And it's like, you know, like my dream world, and you guys are working to build it. But I was wondering if you covered it all here in this talk, or if right to repair obviously overlaps a lot with the concept of sustainability.
Yeah.
Not just sustainability for the environment, but sustainability in general. It is incredibly wasteful to say, if I just need to fix the camera component of my cell phone, that I need to replace not just the camera,
absolutely,
which is the only piece that's broken, but also the screen and other components. And so this is highly irresponsible on so many levels. And so I'm wondering if that's like a component in the message, that this is not just a terrible thing to the user and stripping away their rights, but it's also just damaging on so many other levels, manufacturing, industry, environment, things like that.
Yeah.
So if you could talk to about that, thank you.
No, absolutely. You're 100% right. It's the amount of e-waste we're creating is so staggering that every time I try to wrap my head around it, I can't. I think 1 year of U.S. e-waste weighs more than every single blue whale alive today. So it's an unbelievable amount. We're creating an incredible amount of electronic waste, and we're not recycling it for the most part. I think the U.S. recycles about 17%. Even recycling isn't enough, though, because recycling only recovers about half of the metals in your phone. Can't recover most of the plastic. So we are in a really horrifying state environmentally that is created by this throwaway society, by the lack of a right to repair. And I think things like being able to replace a camera module instead of the entire phone they're steps toward a less disposable future. And they're incremental steps, and we're still in this world that is creating way too much waste and not doing what we need to be doing with it. So I appreciate your question. Thank you. Yeah.
So one of the most useful components of an electronic device that is the longest lasting is often the web browser. And I just want to use this opportunity to encourage all the web developers out there to write HTML that supports older browsers and devices, because that's one of the most accessible pathways to reusing an older device.
Yeah.
And perhaps support HTTP in addition to HTTPS, because HTTPS is one of the least compatible over time protocols.
Great.
Thank you for your talk. That was an amazing talk. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for the call. To repeat it, he's calling on web developers to use to write HTML in ways that can support open browsers. Okay.
Hi. So yeah, I'm Eric Gallagher. Was the prime sponsor on New Hampshire's right to repair bill, this
wonderful,
legislative term, which unfortunately, due to being on a lot of bills, I've kind of lost track of what the status of it is currently. But yeah, so at the hearing for it, in the presentation, you mentioned how there's like people who are tracking these state level right to repair bills, but when we had the public hearing for it, in New Hampshire, the hearings, anyone can come testify for it. It was pretty much just me in support of it, and then the lobbyist from the Consumer Appliance Manufacturers Association against it, and then no one else showed up. So I'm kind of wondering, like, where was everyone, you know? How do we get more people to see or to be aware that these resources are out there?
First, I'm sorry that happened. That sounds like a terrible experience, honestly, to be all alone up against the big electronics manufacturers. How that happens is that there are now over 40 bills, and each of them has many, many hearings and committees, and we do our best to follow them and do our best to get people to those hearings, but sometimes they slip past us. I was supposed to be the one tracking our five bills in Hawaii and learned about a hearing an hour after it ended, went and watched six manufacturer representatives get up there and speak, and nobody from our side, and it's gutting. It kills me. So the short answer, though, to what to do about it, please email us, and if you know that a hearing is coming up, we can help get repair shops out to you, help get people who can testify on cybersecurity issues and so on. So please, I thank you for your work, and please do get in touch. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thinking in terms of political strategy, what should the free software movement learn from the progress that the right to repair movement has made?
Oh, wow. That's an interesting question. And I would love to hear all of my coworkers' answers to that question. Honestly, I've got incremental progress on the mind, and that's the first thing that comes to front of mind for me. That, we started with really broad legislation covering anything with a chip, and our model right to repair legislation still does that. And that, so that would include tractors and cell phones and medical equipment and anything with a chip. And what we've found is that it's really hard to fight all of those fights at once. And we've had to narrow bills, had to focus in on specific industries and sort of piecemeal attack different pieces of the opposition. So that sort of looking for ways to put your blinders on and get something done is maybe my first thought there. But I love the question, and I'll be asking other people that too. Thank you.
Hi, I want to ask about the effort in including ISO and C standards.
Can you get a little closer to the mic? I'm sorry.
I want to ask about current efforts and including in ISO and C standards, reparability, transparency, and environmental consistency in products.
No consistency in environmental standards?
Is there an effort, or what's going on with that? In ISO standards and C marks.
Your question, to be clear, is what is happening in environmental standards, or
no, in the ISO standards. Is there
ISO
any
standards?
Is there any force to include this aspect in ISO standards?
Yeah. I think the way that these standards are developed is that they have committees of people from different representative groups, different manufacturers and people who are stakeholders in different ways, and frustratingly, the only way to make change in standards to get them consistent or, have them actually making the changes you want them to make is to sit on those boards. And that, it will be years of discussion and, arguing small points and looking at language. So I think the lack of consistency is the result of the process of how those standards get developed. And the solution to it is to get involved in the process. And you can, as an interested person who is knowledgeable in an industry, you can go and work on ISO standards. I'm not sure about the ISO process exactly, but different. I think as long as you have knowledge and can represent a specific industry or specific area, you can be involved in the process. So, I'm not sure if that answered your question, Okay.
Well, once again, Dr. Chamberlain, thank you for your talk, and also thank you for your work and the work of iFixit.
Thank you. Thank you.